Welcome to the Chicago Hamburg 30 podcast, sponsored by the American Centrum in Hamburg. I'm your host, Andrew Sola. May is Jewish American Heritage Month, so today we'll be learning about Jewish Chicago. Mazel tov. In our previous episode on Eastern European immigrants in Chicago, we learned a little bit about Jewish immigration. For example, we noted that in some places, like the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Jews were citizens, and in other places, like in Russia, they were not. We also learned that the U.S. government had varying approaches to managing immigration, often in discriminatory ways, and these approaches affected Jewish immigration quite a bit. Remember also that the first lesson we learned in pretty much every episode that we've done is that it is very difficult to define any group of Chicagoans as a monolithic group. For example, the various Native American tribes in Chicagoland had very different views about how to interact with the federal government. And these views changed over time. We also learned that the different waves of ethnic German immigrants, which we lump all together as being German, came from different countries and had radically different views about politics and society. Well, maybe all the Polish immigrants were the same. No, they weren't. There were Poles from three different nations coming to Chicago because Poland was divided into Prussia, Russia, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And they disagreed quite a bit about what it meant to be Polish. And so too with Black Chicago. We learned that Black Chicago is multifaceted and rich with competing narratives about Black history, culture, and identity. So it bears keeping all of this in mind as we talk about Jewish Chicago, whose history is as complicated as all of the histories we've discussed so far. Fortunately, we have two experts here to help us understand the complexity of Jewish Chicago, Joe Kraus and Tobias Brinkmann. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We met Tobias already in our episode on Eastern European immigration. Tobias is the Malvin and Lee Bank Associate Professor of Jewish Studies and History at Penn State University and Director of the Jewish Studies Program. His book, Between Borders, The Great Jewish Migration from Eastern Europe, is forthcoming with Oxford University Press this year in 2024. He has done extensive research about Jewish history in Chicago, and his book, Sundays at Sinai, A Jewish Congregation in Chicago, was a finalist for the National Jewish Book Award in 2012. Joe Kraus is professor of English and theater at the University of Scranton. He is a historian of Jewish gangster lore whose research and writing focuses on Chicago's Jewish history. He is the former president of MELIS, which is the Society for the Study of Multi-Ethnic Literature in the United States. And he is the author of The Kosher Capones, A History of Chicago's Jewish Gangsters. So let's start with the first Jewish immigrants in Chicago, Tobias and Joe. When did the first Jewish immigrants arrive, and why did they come to this little city, which wasn't really even a city yet, in the middle of Indian country, in the middle of the Midwest?
So maybe I start. Is that okay, Joe?
Please.
They were among the pioneers, so that's really important in Jewish history, because Jews were often seen as outsiders or strangers. In Chicago, Jews were among the first settlers, and that really matters. I think that's actually similar for other cities in the United States, and that's an important part of American Jewish history, and Jews are very proud of that, I think. Why did they go to Chicago? That's a really good question. There were opportunities there. That's why these settlers came. And I came across this topic really by chance because I was looking for a topic about German Jewish history. And in the 90s, when I was a graduate student, a lot of topics were already taken. And so I looked at Jews who moved to the United States in the middle decades of the 19th century. And this is a topic that was not very popular in American Jewish history because these were Jews who were very successful economically. And they were sort of the small establishment in the 1880s when larger numbers of Jews were coming from Eastern Europe. And so they were perceived as arrogant and rich and embarrassed by the new arrivals. And I simply chose Chicago because it was not as big as New York and seemed really interesting. And there also were a lot of other German speakers there. And it turned out to be a really fascinating choice. I discovered that not only that these Jewish immigrants, the first pioneers who moved there for opportunities, there were many were peddlers initially. This is a really uniform experience for these Jewish immigrants from the German states. They came from small villages in what's today South Germany, Bohemia, also the province of Posen, which is part of Poland, was part of this Polish partition. And they came from villages. They were very poor, and they had been excluded from many occupations because of restrictions that applied. And most Jewish men were working as peddlers in this period in South Germany, in Alsace. That's another important region where migrants left. And they were seemingly paradoxically leaving in a time when things were getting better, actually, in Central Europe. And their departure was not really connected to anti-Semitism or persecution. It was really very similar to the other people who were leaving. They were looking for better opportunities. And Chicago turned out to be a good bet. But it turns out that many of the Jews who settled in Chicago didn't initially settle in Chicago. They moved around a lot. Many moved, spent time on the East Coast. They went to the South. They were literally looking for opportunities, often peddling things on the road, used clothes, dry goods. And they did this to accumulate a little capital. And then they opened small stores in small towns. And I could really prove, looking at the census, that many consciously had already planned to move to Chicago, but they didn't have enough money. So they settled in towns around Chicago, in northern Illinois, in Indiana. And usually it's brothers and sisters. And one brother already was in Chicago. And then eventually, after a decade or so, they all came together in Chicago and started businesses, especially in the garment sector. So again, the stereotype is Jews and banking. And yes, there were a few Jews in banking, but also a lot of others. Jews were really concentrated in the garment business, especially in the ready-to-wear menswear business. And they dominated that even nationally by the end of the 19th century. And Chicago is very much at the center of this. Another big sector, not surprising, is department stores, retail, often, again, selling clothes, ready-to-wear clothes for men and women. And it's a remarkable success story. And it's connected to high social mobility, is connected to a lot of mobility moving around the country before settling in Chicago. And this is interesting because there's one parallel to this, and that's actually Germany. In one generation, these Jewish migrants essentially moved from the margins of, you know, rural societies where they had grown up, often speaking Yiddish in rural Germany, to a solid middle class existence in owning their nice house in a decent neighborhood. And that's very similar in Germany. And that has a lot to do with education. They were well educated. They often attended elementary schools before they moved to America, men and women, so boys and girls. And so they were ahead of the time. They were modern before modernity even existed. They were very much tied to ideas of the Enlightenment. They understood that America was built on these ideas. And it's really a fascinating story. So they very much were invested in Chicago. They were invested in progress. They were invested in making this a better place. And I maybe stop here, but it is also the story of Reform Judaism, which is originates in the German states, but it really flourishes in the United States because there were no restrictions by the government, and Chicago became a center of radical reform. And radical reform meant very much looking towards Germany, not towards political Germany, but more towards a cultural universal idea that was connected to the Enlightenment. And Chicago is the big center of that. And that meant actually sticking to German as a language of the, so the sermons were given in German in these reform congregations into the 1870s. And they considered themselves German, but in a cultural sense. And they were certainly proud of, German unification. Jews were heavily invested in organizing the so-called German community, because they were insiders when they were still outsiders elsewhere. The other German speakers accepted them. So they're very much part of that broad, very heterogeneous German-speaking community. But they also were very proud of their own community. So, example, in 1871, Jews were actually leading the parade celebrating German unification through Chicago. But there were no Jewish congregations or Jewish associations in this parade. In 1868, there's a Jewish parade in Chicago, and it's only Jews, celebrating the opening of the first Jewish hospital. So there's really a sense of Jewish identity. They're connected to the German, this broad German community. But they're really, it's an individual involvement. It's not a, they didn't really consider themselves, the Jewish community was not part of the German community, which didn't really exist in the first place. Yeah, Joe certainly has something to say also.
I would just add, I mean, Tobias wrote the book, so that's, I defer to him. Just the larger notion of Chicago as this, as an economic powerhouse with a gravitational pull. So I love the way you're describing the sense that their Jews are distributed throughout that Midwest region, but there are so many opportunities in Chicago. They're both drawn to and pushed toward at the same time, right? Chicago is where so much of it is happening, and Jews that initial wave of German Jews are able really to establish themselves in deep-seated ways that are going to shape then and influence the waves of immigration that follow, which is where most of my emphasis is, but that foundational community is really, really powerful.
Before we get to some of these later historical developments, I do just need some clarification about so many things. And one was the connection between German Jews and non-ethnic German immigrants in Chicago. So to what extent are they really thinking of themselves as being the same or different?
That's a crucial question. So I think you already discussed in other podcasts that the community of German speakers was really fluctuating. It was never tight-knit. It's really not comparable, say, to Poles, who had their own issues. And Jews were heavily invested in organizing this community of German speakers. Why? This has a lot to do with the political situation in the 1850s in particular. German and Irish immigrants, or German-speaking and Irish immigrants, were under pressure from sort of a very small native-born elite. That's sort of a rearguard fight. They tried to ban the selling and consumption of alcohol. There's a notorious election in 1855, and that really mobilizes Irish and German-speaking migrants because they see their culture and their way of life threatened. And the leaders are Jewish, which is really fascinating. And I think the explanation is that this was Jews had been marginalized for so long, in a sense, and here they can take charge. It's a story of agency. So the Jews were involved in Chicago politics from the very beginning, earlier than in other centers in the Midwest, which is interesting. So the first Jew being elected to the city council is Henry Greenebaum in 1856. He runs as a Democrat, which is fascinating, because most other Jews were involved actually in founding the Republican Party. So they actually knew Abraham Lincoln. It's a fascinating story. But Greenebaum was a Democrat. Why? He understood that the Irish were a force to be reckoned with. And the Irish faced much more discrimination and abuse than Jews because they were Catholics and they were hated by the establishment in the United States. But Chicago was becoming a diverse, multi-ethnic, multi-religious city. And it was clear that politics was a way in for the Irish. And so it was a smart move, actually, for Greenebaum to be a Democrat. And he became a broker in the 1850s, in the Civil War period, which was very divisive. And he was actually leading that German parade in 1871. It's a kind of interesting story. And he was a very popular figure throughout his life. And actually, he was a banker. So there's that. And I also want to emphasize the term German Jews doesn't show up in the sources. So it's a tricky term. I have argued that we should probably not use it because it's part of the collective memory of these sort of arrogant, rich Jews. The term really is only connected to German culture. And so the meaning really is connected to Judaism. It's a religious term. It's not an ethnic term. So as a historian, I'm very cautious in using it. I just use more terms like Jews from Central Europe. I emphasize that many grew up speaking Yiddish, actually, and that Germanness was really a cultural identity, not a political identity. There's growing skepticism about the developments in Germany, the rise of anti-Semitism. All of that is followed very closely by Jews in the United States, and they're very concerned about that.
I just want to follow up with two additional questions. One about the so-called ethnic regiments or the German ethnic regiments in the Civil War, of which many came out of Chicago. I was wondering to what extent German Jews, even though we can't use that term, were involved in that. And the second question has to do with Yiddish versus German and the German language newspapers like the Staatszeitung in Chicago at the time. So to what extent is a newspaper like the Staatszeitung considered to be German or German Jewish, or is there no distinction?
The regiment is interesting. So in the Civil War is, of course, a decisive turning point in the history of Chicago more generally. In part for economic and strategic reasons, the city was located far enough from the fighting that it could serve as a hub for supplies. And that, of course, benefited businesses in Chicago that, as it so happened, Jews were very involved in. So processing of meat, the garment sector, and so forth. So it was really a turning point, department stores, retail. So it was really decisive in that regard. It is also a decisive moment following this rise of nativism in the 1850s for many immigrants to prove to other Americans that they were real Americans. And it is the first time that all Jews in Chicago actually meet in one place, because there were a lot of divisions, especially religious divisions, between more modern and progressive Reform Jews and those who were more committed to the tradition. And the war is the moment where they all come together. And the goal is to basically raise a Jewish company that's part of that regiment. It's mostly a German-speaking regiment, also included a Scandinavian company. And this is one of two cases in the Union where we have actually all Jewish companies. And by the end of the war, very few Jewish men were left. So there's a lot of fluctuation, but this regiment is important. It was led by Friedrich Hecker, who was an important 1848er who had moved to Missouri. Fascinating figure because he was anti-Semitic openly in the 1840s. And he actually openly distanced himself from anti-Semitism. It's a fascinating story. And said anti-Semitism is wrong. It's used to for political ends. And I understand that I was on the wrong path. And I was wrong. It's fascinating. Hecker, and of course, this is an ideal shared by the Jewish community in Chicago, were fierce abolitionists. That also applies to Henry Greenbaum. The Democrats were often accused of being supporters of slavery, but they were actually divided on this nationally. So slavery is an issue in Chicago where most people in the city are really strongly committed to abolishing it. And this is yet another really parallel that comes up in the speeches. So, comparing Jewish history in Egypt to the situation of slaves in the South, and that Jews have that duty to defend the Union and to get rid of slavery. So that's a powerful moment. And several Jews are making careers during the war. So one Chicago Jewish alderman, who's actually from Schleswig-Holstein, Edward Solomon was his name. He was actually a Hecker's successor as leader of this regiment, as a colonel, and he was essentially promoted to general after the war was over, a sort of an honorary promotion. And he brought this regiment back to Chicago. And there's a very powerful speech by the mayor who reminds everybody of the nativists in the 1850s and basically arguing, look here, the immigrants, they stepped forward. They were essential for the victory in the Civil War. The newspaper is interesting. The Illinois Staatszeitung is a daily newspaper. It had its political issues. So there were certainly many German speakers and also some Jews who didn't support the paper. But generally, I was surprised how many events in the Jewish community were covered by the paper. And again, German is not just a spoken language. Jews very consciously spoke this language because it was a language associated with the Enlightenment, with modernity. So this is about Schiller and Goethe. This is hugely important for Jews, more so, I would even argue, than for other German speakers, because this ideal of universalism, of equality, of freedom that the United States was built on. So they understood this. And there are a couple of other figures like Karl Schurz, 48ers, who also were quite aware of that. So there's a real connection there between the Enlightenment in Europe and the American Revolution and what happens, especially in the period of the Civil War. And politics, of course, is also a dirty business, and Chicago becomes known for that. And so, you know, the Illinois Staatszeitung's founder, Hesing was his name, certainly a complicated figure. But the paper is really the main paper for the Jewish community into the 1870s, when we have Jewish weeklies in English, and then gradually the use of German just fades away, and English is the spoken language.
Okay, so we've covered a little bit about the complexities in describing German Jews, and we've covered the Civil War period, and we started getting into the post-war period. We started talking about the garment industry. What's the next important chapter in the story of Jewish Chicago?
Well, I might say when you look at Chicago, one of the traumatic incidents, of course, is the Great Fire in 1871. And part of what happens there, it's, of course, the city, like all of the United States, is rebuilding after the Civil War. But in Chicago, it's in some ways localized from the rebuilding of after the fire. So you have, in some ways, an unprecedented experience, really explored by one of our shared professors, Carl Smith, this sense that you have a population center and an economic center that has almost no infrastructure because the fire has taken so much of it. So you have this rapid phoenix-like rebirth of the city, and it allows a lot of reshuffling of the physical city of the Chicago, but then the communities that form as a consequence of and the drivers of that rebirth and that rebuilding. So it's in that space that you get an interesting kind of reshuffling then of what constitutes a Jewish presence in the city. It's still a little early for the great waves of immigration to take place, but you have the sort of established German Jewish community that is, as Tobias says, so centrally involved in retail and all sorts, supplemented by a kind of professional class coming largely from Bohemia. It's a smaller wave, it's sort of a wave at 1.5 way between the original Germans and then the subsequent Eastern Europeans. But that, and I'll look to Tobias for affirmation of this, but in my experiences, that many of those people come in have a lot to do with the politics, the law, the legal. I think perhaps banking as much, I'm not less familiar with that, but they become a kind of professional class that forms around this retail foundational class.
The fire is really interesting. Initially, people are fleeing the city, and Jewish communities in the surrounding city, so St. Louis in particular, actually take in Jewish refugees from the fire. And then paradoxically, and this certainly came up in the podcast about the Germans more generally, it's a disaster for German speakers, most of whom live on the north side, and this is an area that's completely wiped out. It's the best thing that could have ever happened to the city in economic terms, because this very congested center of the city just is gone, and Chicago's center, the Loop, becomes the first modern central business district in the United States So there really are not people living there. It's just office buildings. And of course, that's connected with the history of architecture, right? The high-rise buildings for which Chicago has become so famous. And actually, one of these architects, Denkmar Adler, is the son of a rabbi from Thuringia. So even there we have, in the Civil War veteran, I should mention, fought throughout the war. And he himself was born in Thuringia, so he's not born in America. And he is one of the involved in one of these two important firms. So Adler and Sullivan is one of them, and the other is Burnham and Root. And they built these high-rise concrete steel buildings. Fascinating story. And they also built quite a few, Adler and Sullivan built quite a few synagogues in Chicago, because this is now the time when the community, the members are wealthy, the business establishment, and they can afford the construction of beautiful temples that are very much following the European model. So they look very similar to synagogues in cities like Hamburg or Budapest and Berlin. And they're pretty grand. It's really a pity that they really didn't survive. That's another side of Chicago. It's quick change and fluctuation. But it's a very complicated period. 1873 is a recession that's really hard on many working people in the city. And I looked at the files of the Jewish Community Association that supported poor Jews. It's really a tough time. It's another fire in 1874. That fire was much worse for the Jewish community. The Jewish community in those days, in 1871, most Jews lived actually in the southern loop that was not affected by the fire. But the 1874 fire wiped that out. And as a historian, there wasn't much material I could find from the period before 1871 or 1874, because it was simply destroyed in these fires. And that's similar for other scholars. So that's a little bit of a problem in Chicago history. San Francisco is another example where the fire just destroyed a lot of records. So that's a bit of an issue.
All right, well, let's move on to the next phase, the post-fire, post-reconstruction, and we get to the 1880s. Is this around the time that the stockyards become extremely important in the development of the city and the new railroad network?
Yeah, maybe I jump in again, sure. Because the stockyard story is really fascinating. So that's very important for immigrants like Polish and Lithuanian immigrants. One of the stockyard owners is sort of a typical rags-to-riches story that begins in the Black Forest. It begins with the son of a cattle dealer. So Jews were marginalized into economic niches. I always say the proto-capitalist niches of a feudal economic order in the early modern period in Central Europe. Cattle dealing is one of those niches. And there's a direct line from cattle dealing to the processed meat industry as it emerges in the middle decades of the 19th century in the United States and also in Germany, interestingly. And a big issue here is refrigeration, which is invented in Chicago. So this is all about exporting meat, eventually even across the Atlantic. And one of these rags to riches stories involves this man, Nelson Morris, who initially moved around a lot. He was in Connecticut. He was in coal mining in Pennsylvania. And eventually he starts in the stockyards in the 1850s. Sets up a business, and it becomes one of the largest processed meat businesses in the United States. By the time he died in 1907, he's one of the probably 10 richest Americans. Fascinating story. He was a member of a Reform Jewish congregation in Chicago. Yeah, he was sort of a boosterish, typical capitalist, you could say. Not necessarily a nice man, but the story is fascinating, I have to say. And it is a story we know from the jungle, of course, that didn't work so well for the people who worked there, but it is quite typical for Chicago. Chicago is a processing center for livestock, lumber, and grain, and increasingly the meta market for trading in these what we now call commodities. And again, several Jewish figures are involved in it. They do not control it. They're actually more on the margins of it. But it's interesting that they're there. They're insiders. And I just want to mention very quickly, crucial also in the fire is insurance. And in the late 1860s, a number of insurances in New York literally excluded Jews because they were supposedly connected to fires and starting fires and cheating insurance companies. And in Chicago in 1867, there's a public rally. Greenbaum obviously is involved. the mayor gives a speech and basically says these are outrageous stereotypes. We reject this. All leading businessmen in Chicago stand behind our Jewish partners and colleagues, and not in Chicago. So, and the insurance issue is a big one in the fire because some people had the bad luck of having bought insurance locally. And of course, the fire wiped out these local insurances. But those who had actually bought insurance in New York obviously were able to restart their businesses pretty quickly because they had capital coming back into the business. 1870s are complicated economically. Another recession in 1877, there's growing violence. And then we have this rising immigration from Eastern Europe. And I think Joe can say more about that because that's a real turning point. Because in 1880, the number of Jews in Chicago is not insubstantial, about 10,000. But then we have a dramatic growth period with the immigration, and Chicago emerges as a major center of Jewish life internationally.
I mean, for what it's worth, I tend to think of Jews as largely excluded from the meatpacking industry in large part because so much of it is pork. So it flies in the face of a lot of kosher. It also, the slaughter itself is typically not kosher. Not to say that the majority of Jews are practicing kosher laws to that degree. It's just sort of culturally out of step with the Jewish experience. So there are much smaller, some of the kosher meat industries that do develop, but I think they tend to be overshadowed. They're more marginal. The kosher hot dog, I can't speak to whether it's how it develops separately in Chicago than in New York. My sense is that they're more smaller industries. I know I had a relative who worked in that field, that worked for David Berg hot dogs kind of a thing. But I think what this notion that in the 1880s you get these massive waves of immigration, that's the moment when Chicago as a city is kind of flexing its might. You get that's where the Carl Sandburg city of broad shoulders kind of notion comes in. You have this city that because it grows, the growth is so dramatic from the period of the fire until the first World's Fair. It's this staggering period when we see it in the 20th century. We see it in some of these Chinese cities where you have something that isn't a city one decade and the next it's a massive center. So Chicago, because in part of the reset of the fire, goes from a smallish town into one of the world's centers of trade and industry. So quickly, and in the course of that, it can bring in so many groups of people, and that's the same moment, the 1880s, coinciding with these waves of immigration, many communities, but Jews are disproportionately represented in that, arriving in Chicago and really just transforming the whole city. So you get, I always like to say to listeners familiar with the New York experience, the analog of the Lower East Side in New York, which is predominantly Jewish, is the Maxwell Street area in Chicago. And in the 1870s, 1880s, that just mushrooms. It's a period of first arrival. It's densely packed. You have push carts. You have many of the peddlers that Tobias is talking about at that point. It's another generation, but they're essentially reloading. They'll come to Maxwell Street for their wares, and then they'll just head out, push cart peddlers going in all directions. It's also where you begin to see a different kind of Jewish political experience. You have a man named Manny Abrahams, is someone I've done some real looking into, who emerges from that Maxwell Street area as a representative, not just of the Jews, because the Jews constitute perhaps a plurality, but definitely not a majority within the ward. But he's able to piece together a kind of coalition of the disaffected working class.
It's a fascinating story, again, because we have a real split now in the community. So we have this really well-to-do business establishment, almost exclusively middle class and upper middle class, some very wealthy. And all of a sudden, there's a large number of traditional Jews and also some socialists arriving. And so initially, the perception is quite negative. It's sort of almost this negative past that they had left behind in Europe. It's coming back. It's catching up with them. This is also the period of anti-Semitism rising in Germany politically in the early 1880s. So this is a period of great concern. But there's a lot of outreach, and it's actually a much more positive story. In the collective memory, it's really the, you know, this division. But in reality, there were a lot of contacts, and but there is real conflict. And Joe already hinted some of the immigrants joined the Democrats, and many of the established Jews were Republicans. So there's that political division, and then it's also a story of employers and employees. So many Jewish immigrants ended up men, and especially young women, in the garment sector, and the owners were often members of the Jewish establishment from small villages near Kaiserslautern in the Palatinate. It's a powerful network and in this garment business. And this all comes to the fore at a big strike in 1910, when, in a sense, these Jewish workers, actually a woman starts the strike by walking out, Hannah Shapiro, and one of the employers begins to talk with his workers and is very distraught when he realizes what their living situation is really like. And, you know, this leads to an agreement, to the rise of an important union in American history. And this employer, Josef Schaffner, was ostracized by the other established Jews for cutting a deal with his workers. Quite an interesting story. But it really shows the beginning of these different groups coming together. Zionism supposedly is only a force among the new immigrants. In reality, many of the established Jews are also really sympathetic to Zionism. And there's real interest in that. So again, during the First World War, we have that really coming together as all Jews join in coming together to help Jews in Eastern Europe who are affected by the horrific war in that region. And again, I wanted to mention very briefly, the NAACP was founded in Chicago following a race riot in Springfield, and a number of prominent Jewish figures were involved in that, and that's really important. So Julius Rosenwald, very important entrepreneur in Chicago, who was born in Springfield. His parents came from North Germany, his mother came from Bremen, and his father from Herford near Osnabrück. And he is the real force behind Sears and Roebuck, a mail order firm. It's a quintessential Chicago business it's all about location and railroads, the catalog and distribution, sort of the Amazon, the model for Amazon. And Rosenwald saw the potential. He became a partner in the 1890s, and he made that business big. He took it public in 1906, and he became very wealthy. And he was very concerned about the situation of African Americans in the South. And so the race riot is sort of the trigger, and a number of prominent Jewish figures in the business establishment were quite involved in supporting the NAACP. And it's also an issue that resonates with new immigrants. New immigrants couldn't understand the racism. It's very interesting. There's a famous cartoon from a Yiddish paper showing an Uncle Sam character and a black character. And shows the Uncle Sam character wrestling down the black character, and it says civilization. And the other shows the black character wrestling down the Uncle Sam character, barbarism. They made fun of it. I mean, they couldn't understand what is the problem. Why are African Americans different? So this is also interesting, this notion of race in America. It was alien to many immigrants until, I should say, African Americans began arriving in Chicago during the First World War. And then we have a significant conflict over space and turf. But this didn't concern Jews very much because they were not living in these neighborhoods. This is more the Catholic immigrants from Poland and Ireland who were involved in these conflicts.
I would second that, just to go back a little earlier, this idea of the politicization, the sense that as these waves of Jews, the children are growing up, they begin to assume political power, that they have some kind of agency. So I think a really interesting hallmark is to go back to the Haymarket riots, rebellions, however you want to characterize it. That's read in the press at the time as largely a German-American experience. And in fact, the most prominent figures associated with it are German as opposed to Jewish-American, Jewish-German. Very shortly thereafter, within a decade or so, there's an incident that I've written about in an earlier book called An Accidental Anarchist, where a young Jew, a man named Lazarus Auerbach is, he goes to the home of the chief of police of Chicago. He's shot and killed by the chief. And the chief says, well, he was clearly an anarchist, clearly here to assassinate me. And there's a lot of ambiguity to this story. But what's fascinating about it, at that cultural moment, you have the opportunity for the established German Jewish community to say, those are another kind of Jews, right? Those are Jews from Russia. Those are Jews from Romania or Poland. They're not us. They're not our crowd. And a really remarkable thing happens. And Julius Rosenwald is essential to all of this. Jonathan Sarnock here, I'm characterizing Sarnock's argument, who really puts it very elegantly. In that moment, when the Jewish community might have fragmented along the lines of German Jewish versus the rest of the Jewish community, it came together and understood itself as a community that needed to remain whole, that needed to remain connected. So by the time you have this incident in the early teens, the politicization that was German is now seen much more dramatically as Jewish. Part of that, of course, is the rise of Marxism across the world, which is seen by some as characterized as a Jewish experience. So Jews who are facing the charge of being un-American in their politics are simultaneously supported by these established German Jews. And it becomes a Jewish community in really kind of remarkable ways. And so I would think that's kind of the central experience of that, the period from the 1870 to the 1920s, the remarkable element of that, remarkable assimilation of so many different waves of Judaism into, of Jewishness into one community that then experiences the closing of the immigrant doors in the mid-20s and the rise of, and the beginning of Prohibition.
Okay, so let's now maybe look at another huge event that's going on in Europe. As we're getting to, I guess, the modern period, we have World War I. And after World War I, we have the Immigration Act. Is that in 1925?
21 and 24.
Yeah.
21 and 24. Mm-hmm. So do we want to just talk about how Jewish Chicago is affected by World War I and then afterwards the Immigration Acts?
Yeah, very quickly. 1921 is a disaster. So that's very clear. So this is a period of turmoil, civil war in Eastern Europe, and the United States Senate and House overwhelmingly, there's very few people voting against it. Obviously, the men at this point representing districts in New York and Chicago, one, and they're Jewish. So Adolf Sabbath represented a district on the West Side that's very multi-ethnic. It's not even mostly Jewish. So Jewish politicians really cater to overwhelmingly non-Jewish constituents. So that's important. They're among the very few congressmen voting against these bills. So there's overwhelming support. This is a period very similar to our contemporary period, I think. There's real fear of global turmoil, the rise of communism, which is seen as a vague threat. And it's a very dangerous stereotype associating Jews with communism. Supposedly all the Bolsheviks are Jewish. Of course, not true. And that sort of explains a little bit why Jews are actually implicitly, specifically targeted in these bills. So if you look at the discussions among the leading senators, there's a senator from South Dakota who says he wants to exclude Jews as a racial group. And then others say, how should we determine that? Showing that race is a construct, obviously. So that there's a real anti-Semitic aspect here involved. It's absolutely a mainstream view to say that these immigration laws were anti-Semitic. There's no question about that. And this is a moment of great crisis. The Jewish community really came together in America in the First World War. There were enormous differences, religious, political, class. They're coming together to assist Jews in Europe in this major crisis. And so they're much more united. And the process of becoming Jewish in an American setting and becoming American are really closely connected. And in Chicago, 1921 is a much more complicated year. And Joe can probably talk about this because there's a big scandal rocking the Jewish community. And it's also connected with fear of anti-Semitism. So maybe you could talk about Loeb and Leopold.
Leopold and Loeb, for those who aren't familiar with it, were two very well-established German-Jewish, children of very established German-Jewish families. I believe it's Loeb's father was one of Julius Rosenwald's closest associates. So these were extremely wealthy, extremely privileged young men who, as the story is typically told, were caught up in the idea of the Übermensch, of the Superman, of this idea that some people are above morality. And really, in a kind of cold-blooded, terrifying sense, they perpetrated a thrill killing. They killed a young boy, also a Jewish boy, Bobby Marks, and having read some Dostoevsky, no less. So there's a sense that it's really a philosophical attempt to perpetrate this crime. It's one of those many crimes referred to early on as the crime of the century. And it frightens many people, in part within the Jewish community. It's terrifying because it suggests this community, that these young people have lost all sense of moral centering, moral foundation. It's terrifying more broadly then because it suggests, it makes too easy a target for the larger community to say, well, these Jews don't know what they're doing. There's a kind of intrinsic violence, inherent violence to it. It's a very troubling notion writ large. A small footnote of it, it may or may not be relevant to what we're discussing here. Again, these are very wealthy Southside German Jews. When they're imprisoned, again, they have such privilege. Their parents don't want them to be eating regular food, treif, non-Jewish, non-kosher food. So it was actually my grandfather, whose restaurant was next door to the jail. And so his meals were catered. The boy's meals were catered every day from Joe Stein's restaurant. Even though Joe, I don't believe at the time, was keeping kosher, it was at least kosher style. So I find that a fascinating glimpse that these people who could so readily be distinguished from my more or less, I think Joe could read, but I'm not sure. There was certainly certainly not a well-educated man and lots of D's and dozes and kind of a very much an immigrant street character. And yet there's that still this strange quality that does unite these potentially disparate communities, which I think is really fascinating. If I may, there's some other conflicts that when you started passing the baton to me, Tobias, I wasn't sure what you were talking about, because the other dramatic thing from my perspective that takes place in Chicago after World War I is Prohibition. And Prohibition is, in fact, one front on a larger war against immigrant culture. As you were saying earlier, Tobias, Prohibition grows out of very much a puritanical sense that America cannot tolerate these other practices. So practices outside what are essentially the for lack of a better term, WASP, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant tradition, frowns upon drinking in ways that Germans and Jews and Czechs and Central Europeans and Catholics writ large, Irish, don't. So Prohibition is both, as it's advertised, this idea we want to combat the ills of alcoholism and we want to advocate for temperance. So there are those legitimate elements to it, but it's also very much an anti-immigrant notion. And so in that very narrow sense of skirmish, as it is a way of silencing the immigrant experience, then emerges what I've spent a lot of time studying, the figure of the gangster, who is first and foremost a criminal, first and foremost a very selfish presence. I don't want to in any way glamorize that figure. But one part of what gives birth to the immigrant gangster, actually they're not immigrants themselves, they tend to be the children of immigrants. One part of that is a response to having been made illegal as a self, as a culture. You're not to be able to practice. You're not the saloon culture. All these things that are associated with the immigrant are outlawed. And then those outlaws grow gradually more and more powerful to the point that some would characterize Chicago's having experienced another war throughout the 1920s. The beer wars is often how it's described. And it's very much along ethnic lines. It's very much dominated by the Italians eventually. The Irish are very important in it, but the Jews then also constitute a separate thread going throughout that, one that's been harder to recognize in the way we typically tell the story of the Chicago gangster.
Well, why don't we just take the opportunity now to spend a little bit of more time thinking about immigrant gangster culture. Of course, everyone around the world knows Chicago for Al Capone, and I think most people know generally the story that he became wealthy and powerful through basically smuggling alcohol and having saloons in the city during Prohibition. But how do the Jewish gangsters, the Jewish Capones, fit into that picture of what we might already know from movies about Al Capone and the Italian mafia?
It's hard to characterize quickly because the Italian story is pretty clear, right? They emerge as through the figure of the Capone gang gets more and more powerful and essentially swallows up all of its competitors. One of the things that I think is less well said is that it's not a series of a small, as it were, like a small state just conquering all the other states. It's this idea the Italian gang under Al Capone grows increasingly powerful, first through confederation rather than through conquest. So Capone's predecessor, Johnny Torrio, literally creates a map, and you can see it in newspapers. It's really kind of striking. It's an illegal activity that the newspapers say, well, if you want booze here, you buy it from so-and-so. In this neighborhood, it's someone else. And it's all drawn very clearly. It's on the north side where you have, it's characterized as the Irish gang. But in fact, I would argue that's not accurate. It's actually much more, I call them the ecumenical gang, if you will. They come from a variety of different places. Its founding figure is a guy named Dean O'Banion, who is very much Irish, but he was in fact an early ally of Jews. A guy named Samuel Nails Morton was his original partner. So there was always a sense that the North Side was less concentrated in traditional ethnic neighborhoods and more concentrated in economic opportunity neighborhoods. So the North Side gang is destabilizing of this sense of isolated neighborhoods that are defined otherwise by ethnic groups. And in that instability, they grow more and more aggressive in trying to sort of upset the apple cart. So O'Banion himself is killed pretty early on. His successors are Polish and Italian. And his most famous one, from a successor guy named Bugs Moran, who, despite having an Irish-sounding name, is in fact French-Canadian. Throughout that North Side, you also have a number of, I like to call them invisible Jews, Frank Foster, Max Eisen, characters who don't make the headlines quite as often, but they're very central in kind of the business side of the gangster world. You characterize it as largely about alcohol. Alcohol is obviously extraordinarily important, but more important from a financial perspective is racketeering. That's where the real money begins to come in those eras. And racketeering is a much more complicated financial crime. You know, it's any number of examples. One classic one was in New York. A man named Sarah Terranova was able to make sure that any artichoke that came into the city passed through him. And he made you, if you bought an artichoke for 4 cents one day, it was 6 cents the next. He got 1.5 pennies of that, of each artichoke. In Chicago, you have a remarkable story about a man named Max Eisen. There were a couple different Max Eisens. And one Max Eisen was able to control the kosher chicken market so that you could get kosher chicken only through him for a brief period. And he was collecting all this money. So that invisible sense of crime is not in any way dominated by Jews. It's across the board. But Jews are more central to that than they are to the alcohol trade by the mid to late period. This North Side gang is eventually wiped out in the St. Valentine's Day Massacre and other incidents by the Capone gang and its allies. Many of those allies are in fact Jewish as well. Capone's number one sidekick was a man named Jack Guzik, who grows out of this whole Maxwell Street era political corruption. His father is involved in politics. His older brother is already very important in that pre-World War I, pre-Prohibition gangster era. The upshot of all of this is that as organized crime coalesces into a syndicate that's clearly headed by and dominated by Italian Americans, there remains a very powerful strain of Jewish gangster who's a part of that. And it speaks to a larger sense of the coalition that emerges out of Chicago of the political machine. So they are separate, but there's a political machine and there's a gangster machine. And in each case, Jews are crucial elements of a larger coalition that forms organically, as it were. It's not like it's not apportioned to Jews. It's that Jews have the capacity to force their way in politically and criminally to a certain point, and that's sufficient. And it arrives at a kind of, for long periods, despite the violence that takes place, there are long periods of stability that emerge after conflict. And each side sort of asserts its turf and goes from there.
interesting. And how did the law-abiding Jewish communities deal with the gangsters, the Jewish gangsters in their midst?
I find it fascinating, again, that this notion that there are certainly there's a finite number of people who are absolutely and clearly gangsters in the traditional Al Capone sense. Right. And there's a dramatically larger community of people who are not just law abiding, but ethical in the kind of the ways I think we hope our ancestors all were. But I think there's a substantial portion who live in a gray space, a very successful business people who pay tribute. Right. It's just easier. Right. You comp the gangster when he comes to your restaurant. It's just easier to deal. Maybe you pay a little protection. Maybe you got a guy on the payroll who doesn't really show up to work. It's just easier to deal with that. So I would argue there used to be this term interstitial, right, where you have a kind of space between defined spaces. And I think that that's largely how legal Chicago and legal Jewish Chicago and legal Chicago in general dealt with it. There was just a kind of an understanding that there's a kind of criminal tax. And it's hard, I think, to accept looking back. Just really, we're only a generation, maybe at most two, removed from this. It's just how you went about it. That you sort of understood there are some guys who are pretty rotten and you dealt with them sometimes happily, right? You might place a bet. You know, you go down to the barbershop and you find everybody's got a bookie. Not everybody, of course, but many of the central people who are otherwise utterly law abiding, you put a little bet down, you know some of these guys, you wave to them. You tell your kids don't have anything to do with that guy, but you know, you all go to the same synagogue, you all wind up with the same kinds of country clubs or whatever happens to be the case. So the short answer is they just dealt with them, right? They were neighbors.
All right. So Tobias, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to briefly say what I find, again, really important about the story is that Jews fit right in. I mean, they were involved, they participated, they collaborated, they're not on the sidelines. There is some anti-Semitism, but the anti-Semitism really affects more the members of the business establishment. This is a time when universities like Harvard and Yale begin to discriminate against Jewish students. They have these informal quotas. So there's discrimination in private clubs. But that's really an issue more for the members of the establishment. And at the same time, there is a group that is apart, and I always wanted to mention that, namely African Americans. They are really not so included, and it's a very different experience. Jews are very much entering America, and many of these gangsters are descendants of post-1880 immigrants. And this is in the 20s, is the period when this generation also moves into more influential positions in the Jewish community, which is becoming one community. It's very diverse, it's very broad, but there's one sort of philanthropic organization which becomes the federation eventually that unites most Jewish associations in Chicago. So this is an important period. And I should also mention, this is also a period after the immigration ends. It makes it easier to build this community because there's less fluctuation. It's a period when many of these Landsmannschaften, these small regional hometown associations, really do a lot of support in Eastern Europe. There's a lot of money sent back to Poland. Jewish communities in Poland could not have survived without that support that came from America. And the focus in the scholarship is very much on New York, but Chicago is also really important because this is a major community now, 300,000 Jews. This is one of the largest communities outside of New York. Warsaw has a little more. Philadelphia has about the same. These are the three largest communities following New York. So Chicago is a really major Jewish community, much, much bigger than other cities in the Midwest. So that's also something that is really important to remember.
Yeah. Just to build off that real quickly, I characterized the Maxwell Street area as the Chicago analog of the Lower East Side. The Brooklyn analog is a neighborhood called Lawndale, which forms on the further west area. And that gets established, again, talk post-World War I, beginning of Prohibition. That begins to be born in the early 1920s. In the early to mid-20s, it's a community that feels quite threatened. In some of the gangster research I've done, there was quite a lot of anti-Semitism in a physical way. So that's the one corrective I would suggest, Tobias. At the working class level, you did have Jews who felt uncomfortable walking on the streets, Jews who would have their beard, the old men would have their beards pulled, the cheder boys would have their books knocked out of their arms, kind of thing. The kids going to have their instrument lessons would have their instruments bent or broken, kind of a thing. And in that respect, there really was a kind of street level conflict that took place in the early 20s, particularly as the Jewish community is moving into what was at the time more of a Bohemian Czech neighborhood. I think there were some Germans in the Lawndale community. That's in the early 20s. By the mid to late 1920s, it is so dramatically a Jewish community that you'll see traditionally signs and windows will be in Yiddish as much as in English. It's a historian who actually just passed away, Irv Cutler, says there were as many as 100,000 Jews in a fairly small area. So this is the most Jewish concentration the city of Chicago has ever had. And in many ways, it's sort of peak in terms of concentration of influence and wealth and community, because it's got a great deal more wealth and a great deal more political power than the Maxwell Street area ever did have. Yeah.
Yeah, very quickly, this is exactly true. So Chicago is a rough place, right? So there's a lot of violence. And I really want to recommend the works of Chaim Potok, a writer, Jewish writer who wrote about New York. And he talks a lot about these turf conflicts, how Jewish kids get attacked by Polish kids. But again, I always want to mention the difference to African Americans, just daily life in the city, which is much more dangerous and scary in a sense. And it is anti-Semitic, some of these attacks, but it's sort of, it's important not to lose sight of the bigger picture, I think. Lawndale is really a wonderful story. This is the descendants of the immigrants are moving up socially, and they're moving to their own houses and apartments in the so-called bungalow belt. Dominic Patsiga has written about this quite a bit. And Lawndale, this is a wonderful story. In the 1920s, Louis Wirth, who was a Jewish immigrant from Germany, did research for his dissertation in the ghetto neighborhood around Maxwell Street. And people in the ghetto basically described Lawndale as Deutschland, as Germany, because that was the place where these wealthier, upwardly mobile Jews were moving, and they didn't like them. And so Germany became a term for social status. This is sort of a conversion. It's very different from the cultural identification with sort of Enlightenment ideals. Now German Jews is a term for Jews who may come from Eastern Europe. They're the ones who are sort of upwardly mobile. They're less Jewish. They're maybe not eating kosher food. And Lawndale is Deutschland, and the Jews who move to Lawndale are Deutschoks, Germans. So that's sort of it's a completely inner Jewish story. So it's quite fascinating.
Okay, so excellent. We've talked about this period between World War I and World War II, and I think it's important that we end our story here by talking about the World War II period in Chicago and then the post-war period. So Tobias or Joe, who wants to start telling that story?
I just want to briefly state that the rise of Nazism, of course, was a big issue in Chicago. It was a matter of great concern. Chicago, like New York, is a center for this German-American Bund, this sort of fascist organization. Many German-Jewish refugees found a safe haven in Chicago. They were taken in. The support structure existed. This is really an important story. Again, New York sort of overshadows everything, but this also played out in Chicago, and there were rallies, there were protests against the rise of the Nazi regime. And again, this is an issue that brings all Jews together, regardless whether they are part of the establishment or working class. So that's a big factor. And again, World War II is a moment like in the First World War. Many Jews enlist, become soldiers, and it's a matter of great pride, and many perish in the war. And some are involved in liberating concentration camps. So the war is a crucial period, again, that sort of confirms that Jews are Americans and they're accepted as Americans. Yes, there's anti-Semitism. I don't want to downplay that, but there's also something very positive in this very dark and very scary period.
Yeah, I think the war effort really does a great deal to Americanize the Chicago Jewish community at writ large. I always think of sort of On the Town as in the musical as a really example of that. The All-American boys suddenly are Italian, Irish, and Jewish. That's how you represent America. It's no longer a kind of Johnny Doughboy in a generic sort of Protestant American fashion. And I think that becomes a powerful moment in the wake of that. This Lawndale community that grows in the 20s and the 30s into this vast center begins to decline fairly quickly, disperse fairly quickly. It is really a single generation phenomenon, and Jews continue to move further to the north side. You have Albany Park, that's near Northwest. You have Rogers Park, which is further north. And then you have the growth of the suburbs of Skokie, Evanston, further north than that, Wilmette. So that Jewish community begins to disperse and begins just demographically to look, quote unquote, like everybody else, while still retaining important institutions, cultural institutions. But that measure of distinctiveness that Lawndale represented really begins to fade. And it's important in memory, but it is really ultimately a story of broader acculturation.
Yeah, maybe just as a final point for me to end before I give you a chance to make a final point. What you just said, Joe, is important to me because what I've seen in all of the different immigrant communities, basically the two world wars really marked the end of those communities as being rooted in their ethnicities, cultural identities, and languages. After the war, basically, they all became Americans. And with that, they lost some of their cultural identity. They stopped using their languages. There were no longer those language newspapers, or they just reduced in number. But the war is certainly, for many different communities, turned them into Americans. So would you like to make some last comments before we end today?
Yeah, I just, again, want to emphasize, Jews stand out in American history for a history of continuous immigration. So the story doesn't actually end. It just continues. It's just different Jews coming to a place like Chicago. And anybody who's going to the North Side today will notice Israeli immigrants. One of my favorite places is Tel Aviv Kosher Pizza, a really wonderful place. And there's a really substantial community today of Haredi Jews, some connected to Israel, some to other places. And they're part of all these other immigrants who've come after 1965, after the United States liberalized immigration. And I think the Jewish story, like that of Poles, Czechs, you know, German speakers, Scandinavians, is one of entering a city of opportunities, as I always call it. Chicago is a gateway city for people from all over the world, and Jews were part of it, and and this is important, they participated, they helped to build this place, to make it a better place, and some were also not so good, like the gangsters, but in a way they also filled a niche and responded to needs that existed. And I think it's overwhelmingly a really positive story. And this is not the case for African Americans. I think this is really the tragedy of this story, not just for Chicago, but also for other large gateway cities, that they were and remain, I think, sidelined, even though today African-Americans are the leaders and have moved to leadership positions. I think that's very important. Politics remains a very complicated legacy, especially in Chicago. And again, it's also nationally very important. So overall, I think it's from a Jewish perspective, Chicago is a success story.
Yeah, I would agree with that and add that I think while other ethnic communities have, as we say, sort of arrived at that post-World War II, a cultural moment when they have the opportunity, as it were, to lose their ethnicity, many recovered, of course, in the 70s. You have a new ethnic moment, which is a powerful thing. And certainly in the Italian-American community, the gangster becomes a central way of reasserting one's part of one's identity. I think one thing that distinguishes the Jewish experience there is that As Tobias talks about perpetual immigration, but also perpetual awareness that the Jewish safety is still more precarious than it might be. So in post-war period, at the same time as other groups have the opportunity to kind of, as it were, relax into identity, you have the rise of Israel, which feels precarious. And so you have Zionism it really emerges, as I understand it. There's political Zionism before World War II. After World War II, there's a lot of economic Zionism, and you have a lot of work. It grows, but you have a lot of efforts to kind of raise funds for Israel, a lot of travel to Israel, a lot of awareness that the fate of Israel is tied to the fate of us as a Jewish community in Chicago. And then in sort of keeping with that, by the time you get into the 70s, you have a lot of interest in Soviet Jewry and the Soviet Jewish experience. And there's an important wave of immigrants that come as pre-Glasnost and then certainly dramatically post-Glasnost. You have really important, small but important people arriving. And all of those things, they continue to, just as part of the experience of being a Jew in Chicago allows access to the city as a whole without reference to one's Jewish past, this perpetual introduction of people who are here seeking refuge in the city is a kind of reminder to circle the wagon. So I'll agree with Tobias that it's generally a positive story. Chicago has certainly been good to my family and to the larger Jewish community that I'm aware of, but it's also been our awareness of the vulnerability at large. And we speak at a moment that's particularly sensitive to that. So I might have answered it differently as recently as 6 or 7 months ago. But the precarious sense of being Jewish persists. And I think it's a part of how we identify and how our community has remained a community from that foundational community to today, to the early 21st century.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you very much. That was a fantastic episode.
Such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay, and for all of our listeners, one aspect, positive aspect also of Chicago and Jewish Chicago is, of course, the artists. And we haven't mentioned any Jewish artists in this episode, but don't worry, our next episode will be about the wonderful Chicago Jew, Saul Bellow, in his fantastic novel about Chicago, The Adventures of Augie March. I hope you all listen. Thanks, everyone. Happy Jewish American Heritage Month. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, as well as the Chicago-Hamburg sister city relationship, why don't you visit us at our website, americazentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americazentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americazentrum.de. Thanks for listening.